Yeah, so my career was an accident.
This is Content Content, a monthly podcast featuring the people behind the content. I'm Ed Marsh. Today is May the 5th. Happy Cinco de Mayo, if that's a thing, and if not, hey, how are you? Happy Saturday. Today's guest is the one and only Scott Abel, who you may also know as the Content Wrangler. He's also a producer of Information Development World, which I went to a few years ago, and he's also an author.
Basically, I fancied myself a nightclub DJ from the time I was 10 years old when I used to have a close-and-play record player, and I would apparently DJ from my bedroom. Luckily, close-and-play record players were mono. They were just a little tiny toy for kids, so the speaker wasn't too powerful. but apparently, I used a hairbrush as a microphone and did a show from my room. Later in life, I decided that my attachment to media was really about journalism and not necessarily about entertaining people playing records, so I went to journalism school. And there I was an investigative reporter where we worked with an organization that the university's journalism department started, which was called the National Institute for Advanced Reporting. At that time, there was no interface to the web. There was just the internet, and there were many databases attached to it, and our job was to find ways for journalists to use tools in the way that we anticipated they would need them today, for example, although we never anticipated journalists being able to ascertain, you know, who's a criminal and who's not, which is apparently has been the focus of news in the United States for the last year or so. But we focused on databases, and so I became really interested in information management. And after college, I somehow did not find my way into journalism because those jobs weren't up. They weren't really available in the way that I would like them to be, and they would have probably created a need for me to leave my home and go to some city for the first time all by myself without any money and get paid a, you know, not so great salary to barely be able to scrape by. And I think what I decided based on fear was I would retreat to something that I knew, which I got my way through college by being a food server and a bartender. And of course, bartender's one step away from DJ if you're in a nightclub. And so I ended up as a bar manager, a DJ again. And that's really where I learned a lot about personalization and the importance of delivering the right content to the right people. If you're 40 feet up in the air over 800 people dancing and you can see them and you play the wrong record and they leave the dance floor, you know you've delivered the wrong content to the wrong people at the wrong time in the wrong format. But then I started realizing when I decided that being in the bar industry was going to be too challenging as you get older. It's not really an old man's game. It's really youth oriented in many ways. I went back and tried to find a job with my journalism. And what I found was articles about the top 10 careers. Maybe you've seen these before. U.S. News and World Report, I think, was the magazine who was most famous for doing it. And then other magazines hopped on. And every year in the top 10, technical writer would be one of those jobs. And they would say, basically, you have to be smart enough to understand other stuff and explain it to other people and do it in different ways, you know. And I thought, I can do that. So I took a portfolio of all my college stuff and some of the projects that I had done for customers on the side. And while I was in college, I actually had a little design firm and also a magazine that I ran and sold ads for. So I brought all that in and convinced a recruiter that I should be working at a pharmaceutical company as a technical communicator. It was my very first job. I would never hire me for that job. That I had absolutely no experience. I of course, had the building blocks, I think, that were necessary. And luckily, I got into an organization where it mattered. And they took the time to make sure that everybody was on the same page. And they taught you what you needed to know to work there. So in that case, it kind of started my technical communication career by accident. And pharmaceutical companies, in a strange way, are a lot like discos. they have to serve all kinds of people. And it turns out that record companies are also a little like pharmaceutical companies. They have to produce products that work in the cultures where they're trying to sell them, right? And pharmaceutical products are for earthlings, they're not for people who live in a particular state or country or region. They're for all human beings, and they have to work across all the differences. And music does too. So if you've ever heard a dance version of a slow song and thought, how did they make Madonna's voice not sound like the Chipmunks? That's a slow song, but I'm listening to a faster version of it, but her voice sounds the same. And so I went and basically studied all of that and used that as the basis for single sourcing. So when I heard about single sourcing, creating derivative renditions, I thought, oh, that's what they do with music. The only difference is we created, at that time, documents from scratch as a single product. And then later we discovered, wow, there are little pieces inside there. What if we broke the big documents up into little pieces? Then we could reassemble them in other ways. Well, music is assembled in the opposite way. Music is assembled by a bunch of little pieces already recorded separately and then brought together by the producer and the director, and they decide what the end product will be. What will the document be? And the document in this case would be the song, the version of the song. And they may make three different versions of the song, one for a Latin audience, one for a primarily soul or R&B audience, another one for progressive, you know, or different kinds of music, basically. And then they just reassemble those tracks, and the differences are what they're catering to, right? It's the personalization, the beginning of personalization. So I feel like content is no different, except for that if we start with little pieces, we can build a bunch of remixes, if you will, which I think is more flexible and more adaptable, and of course more expensive and more complicated, but it also yields much more variety. And so that's kind of how I stumbled into what I study.
Huh, that's a crazy path. I mean, I started similar to you. I went to school for journalism. I thought I was going to work for the Times here in New York, and that obviously didn't work out. Interviewed for a job, and they said, oh, you'd be a good technical writer. I'm like, what the hell is that?
Right.
And it turns out that it paid a lot more than journalism did, so that was how I fell into it. So, you know, I had a obviously less roundabout path than you did, but it's amazing how it all came together and how you've, you know, had that blend of music with content is really a crazy thought.
Well, I also was fortunate by being dropped into the middle of a pharmaceutical company. I was also dropped into the middle of a money bucket. So I wasn't there to convince anybody like I am today to do something differently. Instead, I was there to serve them. And their job was to find people who did not want to do work the way they have been doing. So, for example, one of their questions for me in the interview, which was really strange for me at the time, was, what do you not want to do? And I said, I don't want to sit in a cubicle farm and type in Microsoft Word. And they said, and of course, this was like the only option at the time. And they basically said, good, neither do we either. We have to find a new way to create content because the Food and Drug Administration is moving to this thing called XML. And they're requiring us to submit our documents that way. So, of course, they started explaining it to me. And I, you know, in my immature, less than educated about that space that I was in at that time, I thought it was a stupid idea. Until I met Ann Rockley. And Ann Rockley, for the listeners who don't know, is often referred to as the mother of content strategy. She wrote a book in around 2000 that I was the technical editor of, called Managing Enterprise Content. And she was assigned to work at one of the larger companies that I had been working for as a technical writer as I pursued that path in my career. And it turned out that they were trying to figure out how to put everything in a single source and create multiple deliverables based on the requirements of the government that they were seeking approval from. So the government would say, this is how we require you to submit the information. And they basically built a schema, or for some of our listeners who might not know what that is, a template of sorts that the computer and people can both understand. And so that led me to learn a lot about what was possible from Ann Rockley. And as I matured my learning, I realized that there's much more to creating information than just being able to use grammar and punctuation correctly.
It must have been a crazy I mean, I can imagine the amount of reuse that's possible in the pharma world. So it must have been daunting, but kind of incredibly exciting at that time to kind of be, you know, obviously with a mandate from the government, but to be able to put all that together and understand the reuse at that level must have been a hell of a project.
The important thing that I learned from it all, and it does jade me. I don't always come across as the easiest person to get along with when I'm explaining these things, because I learned quickly the value that a company has for their information when they consider it an asset. So pharmaceutical companies, they know it's an asset, yes, because if they can't get the drug approved and that mm-hmm. information fails them, they make no money and they might potentially lose millions of dollars in research and development that some other company could come along and snag up should their patent expire. And so they're in a race to get their drug approved before the patent expires so they can make as much money in a protected market as possible. And so, yeah, it was definitely challenging. And it made me impatient. You know, I learned that. I'll give you a great example. There was there was a group of writers, and I was in, by no stretch of the imagination, the manager. But when your real manager, that is your client, sees you as knowing more than some of her staffers, sometimes she would say, make sure they do what we want them to do. And then she would leave to go to meetings or whatever she did as a manager. And I would be there and I would think, what are you people doing? What has taken you people so long? And I would listen in on these meetings they would have. And boy, there were a lot of meetings. Less writing, lots of meetings. And the meetings were basically squabbles about things like smooth segues between paragraphs. And so I just thought, you know, I'm going to put an end to this. I gathered them into our little meeting room. I put the speakerphone on and I called the FDA. And I called the contact who's responsible for those regulations and said, is there a requirement for a smooth segue between paragraphs? Shortly after he gave us a few F-bombs about how stupid we were and that if we didn't know how to find and read the regulation, perhaps we have bigger problems than smooth segue between paragraphs. And then he told the writers there's no requirement for a smooth segue between paragraphs. So I said, thank you, hung up the phone. I looked at them and said, are we really going to continue to talk about this? Because the amount of money that your company is not able to make every day from not selling the product is not going to – that it's not going to – your complaint about the smooth segue will not be worth that much money, right? When I say why the project is not right. going and it's all on you because you're arguing about stuff that's not even in the rules – and what I learned was writers felt threatened that somehow they were not going to be valuable anymore and that their creativity was being taken away. I saw it as this is a highly creative right, endeavor. I'm asking you to help us make a product actually become money. And in order to do it, you just have to help us do these few things, right? And so, yeah, it's great that you know all this other stuff, but just do these things. And so my career kind of started as a billable hourly consultant, but as I watched other people grow, I realized there were two schools of this consulting kind of stuff in TechCom. One, take every job you can and collect all the money and do nothing but that. Have no life outside of work. Constantly be doing sucky projects that don't go anywhere, that don't do anything meaningful for anybody, but you get a check. Lots of people have to do that. I didn't have kids or other people responsible for me financially, so I chose not to do that. And eventually I ended up becoming a resource for people in the content industry instead of a billable hourly consultant. And I found that to be scalable or more scalable. And yeah, so eventually conferences and other things came into being. And I thought, hey, if I'm the person that has a problem with learning these things, other people might too. So that's how I became the content wrangler. And the name itself is kind of funny because an angel investor I know recently asked me, why did you call yourself the content wrangler? And I explained to him a similar rendition of the story that you and I were talking about. And then he said, well, why didn't you call yourself the intelligent content wrangler? Because you like to write and speak about intelligent content all the time. And I explained to him that, you know, oh, I don't know why. I didn't think of that. Maybe I didn't know at the time that I would talk about it that much. And he said, well, it's a good thing that you didn't call yourself the intelligent content wrangler, because if only a small percentage of companies around the world use intelligent content, then you're leaving all the other people on the table and you're not providing anything. But your name allows you because it doesn't have intelligent in it. It allows you to provide information about any kind of content, visual, learning, you know, school content, work content, you name it. So, yeah, so now I find myself kind of in the content sector as opposed to just in the technical communication arena.
Right, yeah, that's really interesting, and I didn't think about it in terms of that branding, and I'm sure, I'm sure you probably weren't thinking about it in that way, too, but, you know, it's amazing how just a single word can make an impact on that and how it can affect your brand
and
your
reach. Yeah, this guy was right. I tested it out. So in my more recent role as someone who communicates or helps others learn about topics related to content and its management and its creation and its delivery, I decided to test that out. So I went to a couple of companies that provide software and services to people who create content, but not necessarily technical writers. And one company was a company that makes a screenshot tool. So I thought, well, if intelligent content is like really geeky and it's way up there and there's only a certain percentage of people doing, what's the exact opposite of that? I'm like, screenshots, like you don't really need to, you don't need a schema, you don't need a standard or DTDs or whatever. You just push a couple of buttons, but then you need to manage them. What happens when you get a million screenshots?
Oh, that's true.
Or different versions for different languages or whatever. So I went to a company and asked them to do a webinar on that subject, and I learned that 10 times as many people from my mailing list. So my average webinar attracts anywhere from 350 to 500 people. We had 3,000 to 6,000 people on these webinars with these like lofty, you know, kind of fun topics like, should you use emojis in documentation? Like, who cares? No company's called me and said, oh my gosh, we have a $10 billion problem. And then we just don't know. Emojis or not. Give me the answer. So I thought, well, this is silly, but if people want to learn about it, let's see who they are. And what I've learned is there are a lot of people who create content who do not identify as technical communicators, who create basically procedures and instructions, or they explain how things work. And why not try to get them all in the same boat without making them change their titles? In other words, I don't think you need to be called a technical writer to do technical communication work.
True, absolutely true. And this is something I wanted to talk about because, you know, back when I started 24 years ago, you know, there wasn't a content strategist, there wasn't an information architect per se. It was, you were a tech writer and that was pretty much it. And now, you know, we've evolved and there's so many different more titles out there. I'm wondering, you know, are we spreading ourselves too thin, or is specialization kind of a good thing? I mean, what do you see, you know, what do you think?
I think it depends on the role. I have to admit that myself and other people that you might want to interview aren't always the best candidates to be like others. So I'm not like most people who are in the trade association and membership groups I belong to. I don't work for a single company. I don't show up every day and have to work in a cubicle and do meetings and all the other crap. Right. I took a different path. And there's so many different paths available to people in the communication field. Mm. And since technology is changing and the way businesses are set up, they're changing too. I think the opportunities are all over the place for technical communicators to be involved in other kinds of jobs. And if you call yourself a certain thing, and I called myself a content strategist in 2001. That was the first business card I ever had with that on there. But it was only because I worked at a company that was pharmaceutical. So they are about science and math. They don't care. Like, if you know, there's no title that's more important. If you don't do science and math, you're not important anyway because you're not understanding anything they're talking about. And so the strength was what you knew and what you could contribute. And because those companies were big and they had learned over the years to use their money wisely in some ways, there was a lot of cross training inside of companies. And so I was getting cross-training by going to different companies all the time and seeing how different everybody works. And then you learn things over time. But people in science and math companies, they often get moved around. So in the pharma industry, a medical writer, it wouldn't be unusual for them to join the marketing team for 3 years. And this is not an opportunity that for you to say no. This is them telling you. We're grooming all of our employees so that they know as much about the organization as possible. And when I saw them do that, I thought, wow, this is going to be really good for the writer. They're going to see things they've never seen before, but it'll also be good for the teams they join. Of course, today, this is a common thing now. Anybody who works in an agile environment knows that documenting software, it's better if you're working with the developers, right? And eventually you'll learn some code. You may not become a master at it, but you'll learn it and you'll understand. And I think that the technical communicators right. who get locked into that as a discipline, TechCom only, that it's a trap. And unfortunately, there are people who say, yes, Scott, but I can't get out of that trap. And, you know, the part of me that doesn't like to hear people whine about stuff says, just quit your job and get another damn job. But, you know, I don't have five kids waiting at the table to get home either. So I realize there are some excruciating circumstances. But it does seem like technology has made more opportunities for us than it has taken away.
That's a very good, interesting thought. And I currently work in a major financial firm. So, you know, they're numbers people too. So, you know, it's, you know, I've experienced the same things, you know, oh, it's like people just kind of disappear and they move and it's crazy. I mean, the thing that I can't get my head around alone is just how it's such a big company, how people just come and go, and it just the turnover is absolutely crazy. And you see people moving around. So that's why we're making a kind of our own market for knowledge retention there. But you're right. I mean, it's really hard when, you know, your company is focused on making money and here you are a little tiny team that's trying to take on
work. It's also not a bad way to get a job. So being a contractor for a while in the pharmaceutical industry, you start to realize that that's just your audition. And if they like you after a certain number of months, usually 18 or fewer, they will say, hey, we'd like for you to consider coming on our team and, you know, working with us and so on and so forth. So there are some good entry points from kind of being a contractor or helping on a consulting team. If you do want to move into those other industries, but getting out of them sometimes is hard. I found that when they trained people, the people who were new, who didn't have any history, I like to say they didn't have any bad habits. So I didn't have to train them to stop doing things. I only had to train them to start doing things. So I think it's a little harder for people when they get stuck. I also wonder if your industry and the industry I started in are similar because of regulatory compliance. So there are things that a creative company can do. And, you know, break the rules and then apologize later, that would never happen in a financial services or a pharmaceutical company because of the danger and peril for lawsuits, et cetera.
Right. Yeah, that's an opportunity for us now, too. It's like, oh, you know, okay, you know, you've got all these Fed regulations and you have to respond to them and you have to have documentation and stuff. So it's, you know, so it's real, you know, that's what you have to make sure. You know, that's an opportunity for us as well to say, okay, you know, hey, if you keep it here, all you got to do is reference it. It's right there. It's professionally managed. It's professionally edited. Bang, done. And people are, it's a pretty easy sell, actually. So I'm in, thankfully, I'm in the right place at the right time. And it's interesting because same thing for me. When I started as a consultant and moved to full-time employee. So it's been a great trip. It's been, but you know, it's got to kind of frightening to hear, hey, once you're locked into an industry that you can't get out of it. So
that's hopefully I'll be around here for a while. I don't mean to exaggerate that, but I will tell you that I was assigned by someone to find out what the average technical communicator makes, et cetera. So, of course, I went to that Society for Technical Communication, an organization that technical communicators often belong to. And they have an annual salary survey. And I searched for anecdotes on the internet, et cetera. But then I called 10 managers of technical documentation teams and I asked them confidentially, what's the best way to get a raise? And almost all of them told me, quit your job and go to work for another company. And I said, how can that be? That makes no sense. And they said, what do you mean? I said, you're losing all these people and all the knowledge. Why would you let them go? And then they said, you know, sometimes the new employee gets paid more than the person who's been here for 13 years. And I said, well, I'm sure they don't think that's fair if they knew about it. And then they explained, well, let's assume that our company is going to launch a new product line. And they went to the shareholders, the leaders, and they told them what they were going to do. And they asked for money. And now they're on the hook to deliver this new thing. And they go to the recruiters and say, we're going to need these new people. And they go out and try to hire them. And let's assume they try to get them for the lowest price available. And that doesn't work. And they're running out of time. And they still have this promise they have to deliver on. They've already asked for money. They've told the board of directors. They might have even publicized it. And so now the recruiters go into kick mode, you know, to try to find somebody. And eventually the money goes up. They're allowed to pay more because it's seen as a requirement. It's not that they're just bringing a new writer on staff. Huh. It's that their staff, they're ramping up to fill a department that is going to hopefully provide some major resources of money with new sales of this new product. And so oftentimes you can get in at a new place and get more money. Huh. Another manager told me, we have this arcane system that's modeled after the U.S. military, and it's about levels. Every time you go up a level, or the post office, I think, also has this, and you get paid a little more, and you get paid based on your level. It's not about you. It's about your level. So you could have all these extra talents, but if you're still only categorized as XYZ kind of employee, there's only a certain salary range, and there's only a certain amount of raises that they can give you. So I think TechCon people can get trapped if they're inside an organization that doesn't reward them in the way that is best for their career.
Well, that's fair enough. Thankfully, I'm in a good place, and I won't. I'll just say I'm in a good place right now. So thankfully, that's working out. You know, again, it's hard to be a small fish in a big pond, but you know, we're working through that. It's been a you know, I came from software background from tech companies, and going into finance was a whole new thing for me, and all new acronyms and a lot to learn. And you know, I wasn't even sure if I wanted to work, you know, in finance at that time. But I'm glad I did. So I have no complaints there. I guess one of the things you talked about, you had a salary thing. I know you also recently had a DITA. A salary or a survey about DITA usage, and I'm a big DITA fan. I'm a DITA user. We've converted to it about 3 years ago from an unstructured audience. So I'm a big fan of it. But I do find that you know the implementation of it. You know, I mean, I'm working in XSLT right now, which is driving me nuts. But I think a lot of it, the implementation, and now we're finally, you know, it's DITA is great to author in, especially, you know, to your point, some people find it restrictive, and I disagree. I find that structure to be freeing so I can be more creative, to, you know, follow within the constraints, almost like you said with music, you know, you're working within a specified set of parameters. So I like that it makes you think that way and makes you, you know, structure your thoughts and allows you to be creative and work around those constraints. So can you talk a little bit about what you found and, you know, maybe some remedies that we're talking about here?
The basics things that we found was that there's a lot of people who ask how many people or companies use DITA. And then they use that number as, look, it's growing. And nobody really asked if they were satisfied with DITA. Because if another company comes in and says, hey, why bother structuring all that content? We can help you in 10 minutes get your content out. And if your manager thinks that getting content out in 10 minutes is the biggest problem that you have, then selling the value of all the extra stuff you get when you make your content semantically rich and structured in XML doesn't help them solve that problem, at least not in the emergency state they may feel at that moment. And so I wanted to know, what things do people feel like are bad about it? And so sometimes we learned that they were they had implementation concerns. It doesn't work the way they thought it would. Well, that's about, you know, setting proper expectations. And so if you imagine that DITA will just do a bunch of stuff and you never took the time to learn exactly what it was and how it works, then you might be disappointed when you find out it's not magic. And I think the fact that we haven't stopped talking about it for years also is frustrating to some technical communicators who have not moved to DITA or XML. Because they think, oh, are they going to continue to talk about this for 10 more years? My company has, this is what we heard. My company isn't going to do that. They're never going to do it. And I don't think you should. Not every company should do that. But if you're going to argue whether or not a company that is values the content as an asset and modularizes and controls it and governs it and manages it well, I'm telling you that under most circumstances, if it's done correctly, they could be faster at delivering content in new formats and new variations much faster than relying on me and you to do it all by ourselves, just with our human powered creativity.
Right.
And so I feel like that was the challenge we learned, was there were many expectations people had. And then second, once they start using DITA, human beings are creatures of pattern or habit. we're wired that way, and people will argue that they're not. Okay, fine. Those people, whoever they are, let's just call them exceptions to the rule. But the rule is usually 98% or so of human beings behaving the same way. And in this way, we like the fact that the telephone numbers are in the same place every time you get a phone. What happens if Apple were to decide, let's not do that 1, 2, 3, 4 thing in that way. Let's do up and down. 1, 2, 3, 4. Because we can get more numbers on the screen or whatever. There could be a really good reason for doing it, but there'll be a really bad reaction when the pattern doesn't match people's expectation and they have to learn something new. So I think there's also a struggle from the survey results. We learned that people want to be able to break the rule. So in a desktop publishing application, you know, I could decide I want to put two tables and a picture on one page if I want to. and usually it will allow
right,
me,
okay.
Right? Whereas when we're in an XML world, we might be more constrained. And I think the constraint also added some dissatisfaction. People say, I want to be able to break the rules when I want to. And it's like, well, that's great. I want to be able to do that too. But it doesn't work that way. It's kind of like if we, you and I didn't have the same ability to use the same standard, we couldn't have this conversation between my machine and your machine over the internet. It's just not how it works. So I think there's also that, you know. But the last thing we learned was training.
Excellent point.
There were a lot of people, I don't know where this comes from. I guess this is just our desire to get the best deal. You know, we're kind of inundated by marketing messages about saving money and, you know, value and all of that. And so I've also saw from the survey results that there were a lot of people who didn't feel like they learned everything they should. When we investigated further and called a few of them on the phone just to talk to them, we learned that there was usually a situation called train the trainer, where they would send somebody to the class, one person, and that person was supposed to come back and then teach everybody else. Aside from the fact that sending a technical writer to a training class does not make a technical writer a trainer, unless, of course, you're sending them to training school to learn to be a trainer, then maybe that would be an exception. But usually they come back and do the best job that they know how to teach people, and they may not have the experience or depth to be able to make people understand in a way that somebody who's done it 20 or 30 times has.
Right, and I think the folks over at Scriptorium have just had some kind of blog post or podcast about, you know, hey, how training is neglected because you just, hey, you got a new tool, just go and run with it. Mm-hmm.
I've heard one word excuses like GitHub. Everything I need is on GitHub. Well, you can find a lot of stuff for keyword searching, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be able to, by osmosis, right, soak all that in just by standing close to that document or draw, you know, bringing that website up on your browser. I think there's a lot more to it. So we learned that with proper the companies that seem to have proper education, that took it slow and mapped everything out, had a pilot program, for example, with a small subset of content to teach people the differences. And another crucial thing we learned was they had to have a reuse strategy. They couldn't just willy-nilly let people decide what to reuse. They had to decide, like, are we going to reuse certain kinds of content? And they also had to decide what would they augment with semantic information. Is it just going to be nouns, proper nouns, people, places, and things? And if you just left it to the authors, your creativity, my creativity, we're going to end up with different things tagged different ways. It's just how humans are.
Yeah, that's really cool. Thankfully, thankfully for us, Ditto wasn't a hard sell, and I was kind of surprised. But it was easy, and of course, with a small team, we're two people, it made that, you know, that reuse has just been imaginable, and you know, it's been amazing. You know, even at the phrase level, you know, or at a, you know, at a sentence level, it's been really, really useful. Especially, you know, we're still two people, and all you know, we're getting an influx of people, of teams wanting our information. So to be able to reuse that stuff and snippets, and you know, just like email distributions or URLs or stuff like that, just be able to have that reuse, you know, it's been a really, really amazing piece of it. And the governance part, I think, is a lot of what people miss, but I think it's really useful too
in
the data world.
There's a lot of learning going on right now. It's taken a while, right, for there to be lessons learned over time. But even vendors are starting to learn the lesson that I learned from the angel investor that I shared on your podcast earlier, who said, aren't you leaving the rest of the people out? And so I was leaving 97% of people involved in content who don't know or don't care what the word XML or Ditto or any of these things mean, and they're not there yet. I was leaving them on the table. So too are the CMS vendors who are CCMS vendors, because they're relying on most of the people to create content in an XML editor, probably one of 10, right, on Earth or whatever that most companies use. There might be more, but you know, I would say it's stretching it to say there's more than a dozen, you know, players in that space. But what happens with everybody who's using Microsoft Word and all the unstructured content, et cetera, which is why you can see companies like Astoria, which makes a component content management system, Astoria CCMS, working now with Witty Parrot that makes unstructured reusable content possible. And they're doing that not to I think the original model was, hey, here's a new tool like Witty Parrot, so come use it, which means now you have to stop doing what you're doing today and go learn some new stuff. And you have to install new software, et cetera. But their new model is they made it work inside Microsoft Office. So you'll still need a repository with the kinds of controls a component content management system would need. You're not going to get away with not having that, because some kind of system needs to manage all the pieces. And it needs to be designed to manage the pieces, not jimmy-rigged to get there. The second part, I think, is that in these new ways of using content, if the writer or the content creator believes that it's not as challenging, they're not going to have as many pushbacks. And so just leaving them in their own authoring tool and enabling the authoring tool with some widgets to do things like grab a reusable paragraph means that you do have to have that component content management system underneath. But the authoring environment could be the Office suite. Now, I haven't seen this in action except for demos. And it's relatively new, but I expect more and more companies to go that way, to allow you to bring in unstructured snippets, for example, and maybe store them in a temporary part of the repository and give them a name and repurpose them amongst people who have permission, for example. And maybe it won't just be that you have to open up a tool like Oxygen and start typing in XML or even hide the XML, right? It'll just be part of the system. So I think that more and more people will be able to do these things as the tools mature and new tools come out. Web CMSs are trying to get into this because they fancy themselves being able to help marketing people. And, of course, marketing people want to provide information to different kinds of people, and they definitely want to deliver the right information to the right person, or they can mess up the possibility of a sale.
Right. So, that was my follow-up question is, we talk about Ditto all the time in the tech comm world and how structure and structural set us free. And we absolutely agree. But, the content marketing world, that's what I was curious about, is Ditto moving outside of the tech comm world? I mean, it's been 25 years. I'm wondering if I've had a content marketer on, and she's the same thing. They write in Word. How do you get all these contractors and people to write in a structured way? You're kind of saying they are, but they're not, because of their – basically, you're hiding it under the covers.
Well, I'm saying it's possible to hide under the covers, and I think that some of the vendors are starting to recognize that, and they're trying to develop solutions that will allow you to pay them money but buy something that you want instead of something I want you to want. Right, like I can want you to want this new way of doing things, but if you don't find the value, I'm going to go out of business. And we see that all the time in tech, right? All these new apps and new tools and new ways of distributing transportation vehicles. You know, we have this disruptive thing going on in San Francisco where there's a scooter company that leaves electric scooters all over the place in the city. And then you can just walk up to it with your credit card and rent it and take off and drop it anywhere you want. That's disruptive to transportation. There's good things about it and there's bad things about it. But if I had to learn how to do anything, like drive a scooter, which I haven't seen anybody killed by that yet, but, it would be less attractive. And I think that marketing people have been pushed in this direction, partly by people like me, and Ann Rockley and others. Ann Rockley and I ran a conference called Intelligent Content, which we sold to the Content Marketing Institute a few years back when they recognized that marketers job is to deliver the right piece of content to the right person. So a DJ's job in the nightclub is to deliver the right version of the song. If you've got 10 versions and one's a country western and you're in an R&B club, you know, you have to make a decision whether that's the right version to play. And marketers are about getting the right part of the information to the right person at the right time in their journey when they're looking for information. That involves a lot. And you can't just create 20 versions of it and then say, if you are thinking about buying a product right now, click on this one. You know, if you've been to this website 5 times, you'll want to read this document. Instead, you know, you need to build the intelligence into the system so the system knows that person's new and gives them new information. And they can't do that with the current tools they have. And even though tool vendors will argue, oh, our web content management system, we've been making improvements to it and it can do that, there are still shortcomings to that approach. So I would say the answer is some marketers, very few, are trying to do this. Some are trying to do it with existing tools because the vendors are changing the functionality and hoping to, you know, enable these more precise delivery of the right information. And then there are people who are probably going to try to mimic what technical writers do. And what they'll find out is the tools aren't mature. They're not designed for they're not designed to be design tools. So if you care, about what things look like, unless you make a little extra effort, it's going to look like not what you think. right. And there's not that kind of tweaking that you can do. Like, you know, I have a slide deck. I have issues with slide decks. I have issues with the tools because they try to force you into a bulleted list. And then I ask, how do you compare and contrast two things with a bulleted list? You know, and then how come all presentations are bulleted lists, right? So eventually you get stuck in the structure. And I think that a lot of marketing people are stuck in. This is a template I make for a slide or a webinar or an advertisement or a postcard. And that's what they expect. Mm. And we have to break that whole thing. And I think that's going to be reliant on a new generation of people who are raised creating these small micro content pieces in ways that are governed by some software. Right, it can't just be human beings and their creativity. As smart as humans are, we just can't remember everything. Yeah. If things happen, like a healthcare crisis, or you lose your job, or you die, or whatever, you know, the organization you work for doesn't benefit from any of your knowledge. So I feel like we have to figure out, to get marketing people to do it, we have to figure out more about what they do and deliver tools that will help them do their job the way they want to. Unfortunately, what they really want to do is probably the same thing a lot of tech writers want to do, is they really want us to leave them alone and let them do it the way that they like to do it without anybody telling them anything new, right? Because it's painful. Once they see that you're like, you really? I have to do that to all the documents? And they're like, well, how many documents do you have? 15,000. I'm like, yeah, it's going to take you a while. So the most common thing I'm quoted for saying recently has been, content, there is no easy button. That gets everywhere. People are like, oh, yeah, that's totally true. And I don't have an easy button for it either. And I think if you know, you want to think about content as an asset, you would treat it with the respect that you would money. And until you see that in your company, I think it's hard to get marketers to move in that direction, because they don't get rewarded by that. They get rewarded in different ways.
Absolutely right. And it's funny that you say, we've got 15,000 topics. We have to convert all these. Well, the content strategist, I think, would say, no, you don't have to convert all these. Now's the time to pare some away, and maybe you don't need all this stuff. So, you know, of course, that's never built into that project either.
No, in fact, only when people from our industry have found their way into marketing, and there's a few, and I won't name drop them, but I'll tell you offline in case you want to invite them to be on your show. But there are a few people in our sphere of influence who started in TechCom, who managed TechCom teams, who have later found themselves into global documentation teams. And then global marketing teams. And all of a sudden, personalization becomes really important, because people who speak different languages and live in different countries have different laws and customs. And so they need different words and different pictures and different everything. And yet you can't manage them all one at a time. You've got to manage them and scale it. And marketers need the confidence that they're not going to mess up the way they're doing things today. So if you're a marketer and you think you're successful today, why would you do something new that could mean you screw things up?
Yeah, good point. So you mentioned healthcare crisis, and unfortunately, you know, you've had a scare recently that, you know, I know you might want to talk about a little bit, but I think we wanted to talk about it from kind of the content side. And it's interesting because, you know, you've had a serious illness, but you have that pharma background with the, oh, we've structured it back in a day. And now it sounds like, from what I understand, that you've had some problems finding good content or content that helps you on your journey. So can you... You know, can you tell us a little bit about all that?
Yeah, so the short version is I was finishing up my annual physical and getting eyeglasses and just, you know, maxing out my insurance benefits so that I could take advantage of everything at the end of this past year, 2017. And I went in for my regular physical, and I had mentioned to the doctor that the only thing that, you know, I've really had any issues with was I still have a headache every once in a while, and I thought it was my eyeglasses, so I got new eyeglasses. And she thought it might have been something else, so she did some blood work and couldn't find anything there. So her diagnosis was, I don't know without more information, so I'm going to ask you to get an MRI. So I did get an MRI, and what the MRI showed was that I had a giant brain tumor in my head. Yeah, and within hours, so I basically walked from my office 2 minutes to my doctor's office and then found myself a few hours later in an emergency room where they did emergency brain surgery. And the next day put me on chemotherapy, which lasted for 16 weeks. So during that, it's all scary and not fun. And, you know, as you can imagine, you just have to say the word cancer and people freak out. So it was challenging for me. And I went in and I dealt with it the best I could. I called my mom, who lived in Indiana. I live in California. She flew out. And when I woke up, my mom was there. My partners was there. My friends were there. And there was this neurosurgeon, and then there was an oncologist and some nurses. And the neurosurgeon, when I woke up from my brain surgery, was kind of near my bed. And I, you know, hi, my name is Dr. whoever. And he started talking to me. And apparently I woke up from the anesthesia giving a TED talk about a new medical labeling company for cannabis companies. And I was taking my pharma and medical device experience as a technical writer and trying to apply it to that. And, you know, so that to the brain surgeon, that meant that my brain was working. To my friends and relatives, they were probably thinking, is he supposed to wake up and be doing this? Like, yes, it's good his brain is working, but it's so weird. So I look at the doctors, they try to talk to me, and I look at one of them and I say, so I just had brain surgery, and are you really standing by my bed and then explaining all this stuff? I'm sure I dropped a few F-bombs as well, because I felt like it was effing ridiculous to require someone to pay that much attention and to remember things. So I was agitated that they were throwing all this information at me verbally, and I said, can't you just print out my journey? I got here at 3:45. I saw Dr. So-and-so. He said, oh my God, I looked at your film and there's a big brain cancer. Like, where is this? Can't you print something out of the computer? And the answer was, no, although you probably will find this difficult to believe, it's not as easy for us to piece together all that information with just one button. So there's no easy button, right? There's no just push a button. However, when you check out of the hospital, they give you some discharge instructions, which are definitely built to tell you what to do next, right? And what to do based on what happened to you. So because you did this in the hospital, when you go home, we want you to do this to whatever the reason is, right? And those instructions are pretty good. But my journey through over 16 weeks and now periodically to go to doctor's appointments, what I learned was the contents created by people for a variety of reasons, and they're not business reasons. For example, one person told me that the signs in the hospital, we're talking about signs that could be printed on a piece of 8.5 by 11 paper because they need it, and they need it now, right? They're not going to order it and 6 weeks later get a sign. The person who creates it is often the person who sits closest to the laser printer. Now, so think about that as your business driver. So, like, who's in charge of creating that content? Oh, whoever's sitting next to the laser printer. And because it's a hospital, everything is portable. So it's not like Bob would come into your cubicle and sit there and then, you know, do the work on the sign because you have the laser printer. It would be the chairs have wheels on them, so they might roll over to your station and they're sitting over there. And somebody says, oh my God, I wish we had a sign that said blah, 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 because this is happening and I need to stop it. So then they make a sign. So, of course, the words that people choose when they're working as a nurse or a doctor or some other kind of hospital or medical practitioner are not the words that we would choose. They're not tested. Not that all tech content is tested either, but we always say we know your audience and what is the intent of your communication, right? So we want to make sure that we get our intent there and it doesn't confuse people and mean something else. And we want to make sure we address it to the right audience. But hospitals and medical things are the reason that they're provided are not because of they want you to have a fabulous experience. Now, this is also coming from somebody who laid there for so many hours with only distractions that were brought in externally. So my iPad, my computer, my partner, friends, relatives, but there was a TV in there. And when I first got to the hospital, it was set to the hospital's content marketing channel, basically. It was a bunch of videos from people who had came to the hospital and had been treated in a humane, nice way. And they were telling them how much they appreciated the patient-centered approach. Now, it should be noted that every human being that I interacted with, for the most part, was decent and caring and really useful and, you know, all of those good things. I had a great experience with humans. But the struggle was in, you know, getting the right information to the right people at the right time. They just weren't good at it then. Mm. And I think they want to be, but they've never been trained in that way. So I felt like content people who understand how information should be choreographed and put together at the end and delivered to somebody might benefit from working in the healthcare sector, despite the fact that there are regulatory requirements that make it stricter. But they really do need help. For example, there was a sign about the patient corral. Now, being the content wrangler, you know, I could lasso up a few good jokes about that. But if you think about the fact that the sign was the, you know, welcome to the content corral or the patient corral, I was thinking, what's next? Is there a barbed wire fence in there and they just chain us up, you know, like, and there's a trough that we drink out of? They never thought it was a bad thing because they just call it that and they didn't think about it in any way. There are other signs around the hospital like food is not allowed in this room, do not eat in here, and then in parentheses and tiny type it would say unless your doctor said you have to eat before the test, but in huge letters it says no food in this room. So I mean, like, just crazy stuff. The other thing we noticed was most of the content was focused not on the patient experience, which we, you know, I guess that would be the customer experience, but you're a patient. It was instead focused on avoiding liability or, you know, preventing lawsuits, or there was a compliance issue. And so often you were presented with the danger first. So before undergoing chemotherapy, they give you this pieces of paper that basically come from the drug companies. You've heard all of these words before, by the way. You just probably didn't pay attention to them. You become hypersensitive to them when they happen to you. But all those TV commercials showing happy people running through fields and drinking a bottle of wine, which is impossible while they're running. And, you know, they meet the love of their life at the end of the hill and they celebrate near the ocean. And then you hear, this could cause kidney failure. And la 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 la, like all that stuff is what they tell you first. Nobody comes in and says, Scott, this is what happened to you, and, you know, here's a piece of paper, because later you're not going to remember. Now, why would I say that? Because I work with a neuroscientist who studies content and puts people in MRIs to see what they really remember, what parts of their brain lights up, all that. Uh-huh. So I figured, because I have brain surgery, I must be around people that understand how the brain works. Turns out they do, but they don't focus at all on content. So the intent of the sign or the information they give you might be to just inform you, but other times it might be to, I want to say, manipulate you into doing the right thing, like following the instructions so you don't end up back in the hospital again. It's not a bad thing to manipulate people, you know, when you're trying to help them. But that means that you want me to do something. You want to make me have an action. But what if you want me to remember it? So paying attention is one thing, doing something is another, and recalling it later on demand is totally another thing. And each one of those communications intents requires different approaches. And it was clear that that was not part of the program here. It was mostly confusing things. I think the most exhausting thing for me was when I woke up from brain surgery and felt my body, because something was irritating, and I had a Ziploc bag taped to my body, and inside the Ziploc bag were a bunch of PDFs they had printed out that I needed to know all this information later. So in order to make sure it didn't become, you know, lost from me, they attached it to me, which I get, and they didn't want it to get wet or whatever because of surgery, so whatever. So that's why it was in a Ziploc. But I thought to myself, this is the delivery mechanism? And of course, when I challenged them about this information, they said, well, we've got an app. Yeah, nobody told me how to get the app. Do I have Wi-Fi? Where the fuck is my phone? How do I even get on the internet in this hospital? Like, you know, all these different things were not considered at all. And while they weren't, a lot of them weren't hard. That's a good point, it was just they just never thought about it. A technical communicator might have. Someone who actually went through the patient journey would know that the word chemotherapy has the word mother in the middle of it. So if you make a big sign that says chemotherapy and stick it above the toilet, and you're a man who has to stand in front of the toilet to go to the restroom, when you're on chemotherapy, they're pumping fluids into you, so you have to go to the restroom a lot. You see the sign right in front of you, and it's because somebody selected a font that kind of exacerbates it. But until I pointed it out, no healthcare professionals knew that there was anything wrong with that. And then they would say, oh my God, now I see that, you know? So we have some knowledge transfer we could do that would help. There's even this thing about anticipation. I don't know. I learned this in the hospital too. At first, when I heard the word anticipatory, I heard anticipation. And I thought to myself, oh, the Heinz ketchup commercial. In the United States, there used to be a commercial. And the advertising agents must have thought that waiting for the ketchup, because it's so good, is okay. Anticipation means that you're going to get the best ketchup taste ever, right? Well, it turns out that a side effect of some chemotherapy is called anticipatory nausea. The nausea can be caused, and vomiting, by the way, not to be gross on the show, but that, to just to kind of give you the extra bonus, is that both of those things can happen if you hear the name of the drug they gave you. If you hear it. So I'm now watching television stuck on some stupid channel that only hospital TVs have. And then when I get home, I'm listening to the same news program that I'm always listening to. And what do I hear? And those little warnings during the commercials about pharmaceutical, they name the name of the product that I'm on. They go, for patients that are on blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no. It immediately, my body would tense up. If the doctor said, tomorrow we're going to do your blah, blah, blah treatment, I felt horrible. It was the anxiety. Wow. And so I thought, well, this is just me, you know, so we tried a bunch of different things. Of course, the hospital, the doctor said, let's give you anti-anxiety medicine. And I'm like, well, part of what I don't want to do is give my kidneys and liver more things that don't belong in my body to filter out, because a side effect of chemotherapy can be you can damage your kidneys and liver. So why would I put more chemicals in there? Mm. So no, let's not do that. What I learned was by searching the internet, which is kind of the worst and the best thing you can do at the same time if you're in a healthcare situation, because you can get into that rabbit hole and get sucked in and be, who knows, researching all kinds of things. But what I learned was that side effects of those drugs are things they are obliged to communicate. They're just not very good at explaining them. Like, what do you do now?
Yes.
the answer was almost always take another drug. And for me, that was hard. I'm also an interesting patient because I'm undergoing alternative and traditional treatments simultaneously. So I was undergoing traditional surgery first, followed by chemotherapy, which sometimes is followed by radiation. In my case, I didn't have to do that. But I'm also undergoing, and still am, cannabis treatment, which is marijuana. So I live in California where that's allowed. But not just that, I have a cannabis oncologist. Who is an oncologist who specializes in people using cannabis for different reasons. Sometimes it's just for nausea, which it's extremely good at preventing, and for anxiety and things like that. But other times it's hoped, because there's not a lot of proof yet scientifically, except for in the laboratory, that it also will block the receptors that cancer cells need to replicate, and they'll die off instead of cloning themselves and growing into tumors. So that was challenging, because of course I had different kinds of information and from different sources Luckily, all of the medical practitioners agreed that even though they weren't able to prescribe marijuana or speak about it or whatever at the time, and they all want to, but they can't, that this kind of treatment is just like an added bonus. Like, you know, if that helps you to, the only bad thing I see about it is not a bad thing in most people's eyes, is that I'll never know which thing cured me. So I won't be able to contribute that knowledge to other people, right? So we'll just be able to say, well, some people do both treatments and then they live, and that's what happens. So it was kind of a life lesson at the same time, you know, about this. And I poo-poo this empathy thing. Like, I've heard a lot of content strategists start talking about empathy, and I'm like, you're supposed to be empathetic. It's a human thing. But it kind of goes back to understanding the human brain. If you're trying to manipulate someone to do something for you, I think you have to think not just about the words you choose, excuse me, but you have to really understand the mindset of the person and what they're going through at that time. And hospital nurses, boy, I'm going to tell you, these chemotherapy nurses in oncology departments, they see everything. And I was very fortunate to have extremely skilled, great workers who entertained me about my information management complaints. One of them, however, did bring a woman down named Brenda. I don't know Brenda's last name, but Brenda was in charge of signs at the hospital. There was this one big sign. I don't know if you've ever been in a hospital room to visit somebody or as a patient, but in my hospital, they had basically a poster board size sign with a bunch of fields and a piece of plexiglass over it so you could use dry erase markers to write on it and then erase it for the next patient and start again without having to replace the sign. So it's not digital or anything. It's a marker on plexiglass, and they would write your name and the date and the goals for the day and something funny and the name of your partner or, you know, relative or friend and their telephone number in case something happened. If you were allergic to anything, they would write it up there just so that there was an easy place to look up and see everything you need to know, including like your vitals. Now, all this stuff was in the computer too, but I think that's the challenge. There's so many systems that they use, and there are so many tools and vendors involved, and so many rules and laws, and so many opportunities to screw it up and cost a death or lots of money or both. So I think that's really the challenge for healthcare today, is how do we get past that, and how do we figure out how to communicate to people so we don't scare them more? So I have two armfuls of tattoos. And when you have an MRI and you have a lot of color in your arm, you can have a reaction in the machine. So my arms started getting hot. And the hospital had to develop a new protocol for tattooed people that would deal with that so that they wouldn't get burned in the MRI machine. And then, so I watched them create a process, tell me that it was a draft, it had never been tested before, that I had to sign off on it in order to let them do it. And they explained it all to me. But right there, they created on the fly a new protocol. And then they needed to document that for other people. So it's got to be really hard to be in a hospital and in charge of information at the same time because of the competing interests of all the people who need your attention.
Yeah, it can't be an easy job. And I mean, especially at scale, especially in a place like a medical facility. But, you know, It's interesting. I haven't talked about this a lot publicly, but I'm a almost 20-year cancer survivor myself.
Congratulations.
So thank you very much. Yes. So like you, I'm a survivor. Welcome.
Thank you.
But it's, you know, I mean, back then, I was in my late 20s, so I really didn't care about content.
Yeah.
You know, I just had a physical a couple of weeks ago, and I had it with a new doctor in a new company. Your blood pressure's really high. Let's test this again kind of stuff. And all these things, you should check this with your doctor. And did you know about this? Or they asked about this? And it was like, I wonder why my blood pressure's so damn high. And then it turns out, you know, I went and I saw my primary care physician, and he's looking at everything. He's like, yeah, this is fine. It's, you know, this is no big deal. This looks normal. Okay, you know, and bottom line, you're going to live. But that was, you know, weeks of anxiety. You know, and of course, they knew my history because I told them, hey, you've got to tell them that you've had cancer, you know, as part of your history. So, you know, you would think that there'd be some sensitivity there, you know, and it's kind of just, it just raises your hackles up. You know, thankfully, when I was diagnosed back in the day, there wasn't the internet, so I didn't have any place to research. But of course, now you're like, oh, type, and oh my God, I could have this could happen, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh, and you know, you get a commercial for the medication that, you know, that someone's hawking. It's like, Jesus, it's just, it's anxiety.
Yeah, I'm sure that nobody thought that their patient-centered medicine would be affected by the choice of television service provider, the hospital. We had a choice of 24 hours of the, I don't even know what this is called. I'm going to guess what the show is called, but I think it's called something like Long Island Psychic. And then there was the Comedy Central Adult Swim or Comedy Network, Cartoon Network, maybe Adult Swim. And it was all these twisted cartoons about all this stuff involving needles and shit. And I was like, why am I watching this? And I was trapped. And then it was drug commercial after drug commercial after drug commercial. And I thought, do they already know I'm in the hospital? Have they been reading my Facebook account? Why am I getting this, you know, all of this information thrown at me by people? I even went in to get my MRI, and there is a thing that they do when you have an MRI that allows them to see inside the body a little more, and they add this, they inject into your body this substance that allows them to illuminate your body better and see it better in the picture. And it's called contrast. And so I'm laying there, freaked out, getting ready to shove in this machine that I'm, you know, anxious about because I'm a little claustrophobic and it's really small. And they start to do it, and they said, did anybody talk to you about contrast? And I said, no. They were like, so are we using it or not? I'm like, you know, you. So eventually I got upset. I said, you know what? No, these are not the kinds of questions you ask a patient. How the fuck am I supposed to know the answer to that? Go get a doctor.
Yeah, right.
Go get a doctor and bring him over here, or her or him. And I will apologize to you for raising my voice, but don't come in asking questions. I don't even know what it is. By the way, what if I give you the wrong answer? You know, and there were some instances of that. And that was just really people trying to get done as fast as possible and do the best job possible. They weren't really trying to mess things up or shortcut in any bad way. But you could see how it would make people more apprehensive. And to your point, even later, it can be challenging. In order to have chemotherapy, they put a port in me. So under my skin, I still have it, even though I'm not getting chemotherapy. And yet we've not had a talk until, and I probably won't until my follow-up doctor's appointment, on when to take it out, who takes it out, how does that work, what are the risks, all of that. So I'm still apprehensive, you know, right. And then there's the fear of cancer coming back. So you try to live your life, I think, contributing in positive ways. So I think I helped the hospital nurses, which was good, and they certainly helped lots of other people by correcting some of the things that were wrong. And I wasn't nitpicking about, you know, grammar or punctuation or fonts or anything. I was really just saying, oh, before you start saying things, you really have to think about how you're going to say them.
Right, right. And how do you train someone who's, you know, at that level? I mean, you could have a, you know, hospital-wide communication that it can filter down kind of thing, or someone could create content at that level, but how do you train someone at that level to, you know, to thoughtfully think or to be thoughtful about content or the presentation of it?
Yeah, and aren't they busy enough would be the, you know, thing, because a lot of them did go out of their way to create ancillary materials for me. I had a couple of chemo nurses that were super experienced, and they were just ready to give you any help they could, and they would go out their way to create information for you. So I had a couple of nurses bring me in ancillary materials that they had assembled themselves for me, which of course is a risk to the hospital, because what if it was the wrong information and I relied on it, which I'm not litigious in that way, but I could see why a hospital would be concerned about that.
Right. And I mean, if, you know, as you said, nurses are busy as hell already. If there was a system, you said, hey, you ask for your vitals and your, or, you know, they have your vitals and they write it up on a whiteboard or whatever. You know, what if you could just, you know, put that up digitally, because you said they already have this information.
Well, there's also that.
Why can't there be a CMS or something where they can pull together this information so that way they're not collating it themselves and automate it to make their lives a little easier and they're spending time with patients instead of in front of the
printer? Yeah, I think my last complaint about healthcare content is really systematic. It's about our whole system of healthcare in the United States, and I don't have an answer to how to fix that.
Yeah, there's that.
But I got a call from my insurance company from somebody whose job title was nurse case manager. And her job, she said, was on the recording that she left me to call her back, was she had some program that they wanted to give me that wasn't going to cost me any more money, that was going to help me through my healthcare situation. So I called. I talked to her. She was basically asking me questions about that I know lead to liability prevention. So I said to her, there were a lot of detailed questions, and I said to her, do you know that I just have freaking brain surgery? and I'm on medication. Am I supposed to remember all these details? Or why don't you just send me an email and I'll go look up all the answers for you and then you can call me back. Like, I don't know. And she said, well, because of HIPAA. And I said, okay, I know what HIPAA is because I worked for pharmaceutical companies, the Health Insurance Portability and Compliance Act. It's about privacy and security of patient data. However, HIPAA is not a vocabulary word. Because HIPAA is not a reason. You can't just say because HIPAA and expect some person that's on the other end of the phone to understand you. They won't all be me. Who knows what that is? But that's also not the reason why. The reason is you could say, I don't know what your healthcare situation is exactly, but I wanted to ask you a few of these questions. Let me know if they're, you know, problematic. We could skip them, which you could, but they didn't start off that way. They started off under the guise of being useful to you, but they were just collecting information for themselves. It was nothing about it. It was, you know, about whether or not the hospital had done X, Y, and Z when I was in there. And of course, the hospital charged for that. So I think they were trying to figure out whether they were being charged for the right things or not. And I just feel like they put the patient in this awkward position. So I stopped answering all those calls, and I don't respond to any of them. Insurance paperwork, of course, is equally as confusing. People like Deborah Bosley, if you ever get to interview her, she works for the Plain Language Center. She's on the East Coast somewhere. Okay. She's a tech communicator who helps companies with terminology and clear communication. They would have a field day with these documents. And some were better than others. Some companies sent some really thoughtful stuff, and it was easy to understand.
Okay.
But it was disjointed and disconnected, and it was easy to be confused. And if you didn't have the help that I had, you could definitely find yourself in a problem area.
Yeah. Well, thank goodness you're here. Thank goodness you're better. I hope you have a great recovery. You know, you kind of alluded to it, but are there opportunities in healthcare for tech writers?
That's what I don't know. I figure there's probably an absence of information architects and content strategists in a healthcare setting. They may be part of the bigger company somewhere, and they may work in one particular division, but I don't think that they're there yet. I would imagine that research organizations and organizations trying to get products approved to market are the best place to get involved. But I could be wrong about that. Marketing is probably a way in the door too. Marketing is not just about bringing in new patients. It's also about keeping existing patients happy. So there's that opportunity for technical communicators as well.
All right, cool. Well, you know what, Scott? Let's finish up with something a little bit happier. Sure. So I know you're a busy guy. You're running a business. You know, you've got the conference, which we haven't really talked about. But, you know, what do you like to do, or what do you like to talk about when you're not talking about wrangling content?
I'm not talking about wrangling content. It's usually politics or music or other nonsense that comes out of humans. I'm looking forward to my conference. As you mentioned, I have a conference in the fall, Information Development World. I missed my last one in 2017 because I was in the hospital.
Oh, okay.
It was the first time I'd ever not been at an event I was running, and it was pulled off by my friends and peers, luckily, without my being there, which was a great feeling. Nice. And everybody had a good time, so that was good. But the conference is designed for technical, marketing, and product information creators and managers, people who want to learn from one another so that they can overcome some of the challenges like we've talked about today when content comes from one department for one reason and it's reused multiple times but without consideration of the true impact on the people who are receiving it.
I was at IDW in 2014. It was my first experience in the Valley, so that was a great time. Thank you for that. We got to talk briefly at the end of that show. I had Marcia introduce you to me, or me to you, whatever. I forget about who it was, but that was a great time. I really enjoyed myself. And it's a great time if you can get out there to – is it in San Francisco?
This one is in Menlo Park. We moved it. We stopped trying to attract 400 to 500 people, which used to be our audience size, and have – people in 8 different rooms and competing sessions simultaneously because the biggest complaint was there are so many good things and I can't choose, so I miss half of the ones I want to go to because they're all at the same time. So I thought, I'll use some neuroscience. Let's put people in one big room for like 120 people. Let's keep them there for 3 days and make sure everybody hears the same thing. And let's also stop providing them 45-minute and hour-long blab-on sessions where half the stuff is just too much for people to remember. Human beings can only remember 10% of what you told them 10 minutes later. So as far as I was concerned, we needed shorter sessions, and they need to be very specific. So at Information Development World, we try to define a topic in 20 minutes. What is it? And then the second presenter comes on and says, why do you need to know about this topic for 20 minutes? And the third presenter comes on and says, who's doing it? Let me show you some bad and good examples. And then there's usually a break, and then we come back and have some activities, and then we start again. So I'm really trying to change the conference model so that it's smaller, easier to manage for the attendees to learn, and easier for the presenters to present and for me to organize. And it's worked out really well. People seem to like it. I think they also like it because they can talk to their neighbor. I've been to so many conferences where I'll pass someone like you in the hall and say, oh my God, I haven't seen you for 5 years. Let's get together. And 3 days later, I still haven't seen you again. There's just too many people, too many buildings, too many hallways. You know, you're on one side of the convention center, I'm on the other. So this event is a lot more intimate, and this year we're focusing on helping people create modern online technical support centers for their customers and trying to take advantage of some of the new technologies that are out there, looking at what people are doing with chatbots and voice interfaces and other different techniques that maybe we aren't commonly exposed to.
Cool. Very cool. So what is the date of that? What is the date of
November
that
27th through 29th in Menlo Park? And you can learn more at informationdevelopmentworld.com.
Yes, that was a plug I was looking for. Thank you. I actually met your assistant, Trey, at the conference, too. And we're really friendly now. He's a great guy. So, hey, Trey.
Yeah, I'm sure he's listening in on the show. And if anybody is interested in learning more about the conference, they can definitely shoot me an email at scott@thecontentwrangler.com. Or visit the website and check out the program, which would be going up soon. Right now, we're just in the midst of the call for presenters, and we'll launch some more content on the website soon.
So where else are the good places to find you online now?
I write a little column on Medium, and I'm starting a column with Forbes as well. On Medium, I've been writing about chatbots for Chatbot Magazine and Chatbot Journal. And for Forbes, I'm going to write about thought leadership in the content industry.
That's a whole nother thing. I got I have another hour to your. I didn't realize you were doing chatbots. So that's interesting. I found out doing my research that you are not the bodybuilder Scott Abel.
Correct.
But, I did not know you were dealing with bots.
Yeah. So I've been trying to write a lot and kind of research while I'm healing. So I'm going to not go back to work full time until the fall, but I'll at least pick the conference program and get the conference set up and ready to go. And I'll probably do a few interviews like you are right now with some other folks in our industry just to keep my brain going.
Awesome. Awesome. And you can find all that at thecontentwrangler.com.
Is that correct? That is correct. And also on Twitter and Facebook, LinkedIn, there's a group of about 30,000 content people called the Content Wrangler Community.
I think I'm a member.
You can sign up there. And either way, you'll learn about the many webinars that we have. We host about 100 webinars a year on content-related topics at brighttalk.com.
Oh, awesome. Okay. So that's all the great places to find you. Scott, thank you so much for your insight. Thank you for everything. Thank you especially for your time. So thank you. I can say thank you.
Thank you. I enjoyed the show, and thanks for having me on.
Great. And everyone, you can find this podcast on Google Play Music Podcast. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on TuneIn Radio. And, of course, you can use your favorite podcast client. You can find me at Ed Marsh on Twitter. Of course, you can find the podcast and all the episodes at edmarsh.com/podcast. So, again, Scott, thanks a lot. I hope you heal well over the next coming months. And everyone else, thank you. And go out there and create some great content.